Yeah, but it did the job.
So I'd like to talk about something that I've been thinking about since last weekend when we were in Yakima, and the Lama there, who has the center, Zatchoji Rinpoche, used some language that I thought was really helpful. He used the word reflection to talk about the image of the bodhisattva or the lama or the Buddha or whatever that you imagine when you do these kinds of practices that we've been doing, that you then bring into yourself. And I thought, oh, that's really great. That's great language. And so I've been thinking about it ever since, and I wanted to talk about that. Because to me, it seemed like a key to explaining something about the basic meditation practice that we're doing here, and that's core in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. So, when we've been doing the meditation on Vajrasattva, we've been doing that. We begin with Vajrasattva in front of yourself, and then the process is Vajrasattva comes to the top of your head and then enters and unites with you. And that sequence of the external coming within is at the core of every Tibetan practice of visualization with a meditational deity. The technical term for that is yidam, but I won't use that. I'll just call it an enlightened figure. That's a popular translation for that. So we're to talk about that, because Zatchoji said that it's good to think about the image that you see externally that you're meditating with as a reflection of your internal state. And he said he liked to talk about the essence of the person as being the Buddha nature or their enlightenment nature. And he actually preferred to talk about it as enlightenment nature rather than Buddha nature, to get away, I think, from certain quality of the way in which Westerners tend to think about images of extraordinary beings as being godlike, kind of all this Western mentality baggage that comes with, you know, God as, you know, in some way we have this idea of God as a person. God as, you know, I mean, in the simplest sense, to put a little humor with it, you know, an old guy sitting on a throne with a long beard, and, you know, I mean, I don't know, I mean, that's the way kids, I guess, think about God, but, I mean, there is this sort of sense of, not just personal sense about the ultimate reality, but a kind of projection of certain personal characteristics on it, which have to do with us, which don't have to do with reality, with an R. So he likes to talk about not so much Buddha or Buddhahood or Buddha nature, but enlightenment, the capacity to truly know what's going on and to truly be free and to truly be one with everything else that's going on. In the text we've been reading, the thrust of what Tarab Tulku has been talking about is meditation practice as a way of coming together with or uniting with something or overcoming separation. And it's the same thing. It's getting at how do we forge a relationship with our true inner nature? Because mostly we live life focused outward, focused into the world. Nothing wrong with that, but attending to day-to-day affairs and into a very strict separation of subject and object. And so we end up spending a lot of our time either trying to manipulate what resists being manipulated, so we get frustrated, or feeling separate from what's going on out there, so then we feel alienated from the environment in which we live. So Tarab Tulku talks in this text that we've been reading about meditation practice, as we've been working with it, as a way of uniting with our inner nature, our enlightenment nature, uniting with the environment around us. And those two things might seem kind of contradictory in a certain way, in the same sense of what is the relationship of the meditational image and our inner reality. I mean, there's the outside, there's the inside, and we constantly divide these things into subject and object. So the term reflection, I thought, was really great, because if you think of the meditational deity, or the Buddha, or the image of the Buddha, or Vajrasattva that you begin to visualize in front of yourself in the practice we're doing, as a reflection, well, that's cool, because a reflection is, it's on the outside, but even though it's on the outside, it's what's on the inside. We understand that a reflection is, it looks like it's on the outside, but it's really here. It looks like the object, but it's really the subject. When you look at yourself, and when you look at a mirror, you see yourself, you don't make the mistake of thinking, I'm over there. You understand that I'm over here looking at a reflection of myself apparently over there. So it's really great language, because our natural tendency is to see ourselves as subjects in relationship to a world of objects. So what the meditation practice does is it says, okay, we start with what is your natural tendency, and your natural tendency is to divide experience into subject and object. So even in regards to your own nature, your natural experience is divided in subject and object. So, okay, so great. So here's your own nature, apparently objectified out there. But if you understand it's a reflection, then what you also see very naturally is what the purpose of the meditation practice then is to take what looks like it's objectified, which is the reflection, and recognize that it's merely a reflection and that it's actually yourself. So how do you do that? Well, you can do that rationally, which is what I just did. What I explained rationally is, okay, that's a reflection, and there it is. It's yourself that's out there, and you understand what a reflection is. But there's a part of your mind that doesn't work that way, because you have a rational part of your mind, and you have a more symbol-using, emotional, ritualistically-oriented part of your mind, which Freud called the subconscious, or your right hemisphere, or metaphoric mind, or whatever language you like for it. That part of your mind, you know, the rational analysis doesn't help. That part of your mind wants the message in another way. So that part of your mind gets the message by, here's the image, the reflection of yourself that's out there, and then you bring the image to the top of your head, and then you bring the image inside yourself. And so the non-rational part of your mind understands that what started out as a reflection is now united with you. So what the process does, when you understand it that way, is it works on both the rational and the non-rational, and the conscious and the subconscious level together, brings the two of them together. And over again, you have to go through the process of remembering, okay, my nature is ultimately to be enlightened, to be fully aware, to be fully free, to be luminous, to understand what's really going on. But I spend most of my time out of touch with that. So I start getting in touch with that by recognizing the situation that I find myself in, which is that I've objectified everything, that I see everything on the outside, including, well, actually everything, because you could kind of get into thinking about the way in which we mess up our relationships with other people by projecting our stuff onto them, and so on and so forth. So I won't go there. But anyhow, we start with everything being objectified, being out there. And then in the meditation practice, we recognize that the out there is really us. So I mean, that's in the kind of the Judeo-Christian framework, that way of thinking about things is actually radical, if not downright subversive, because the basic, as Loy knows, the basic view in the mainstream Christian church is God is over there, and you're here, and there's a certain way you're supposed to behave, and if you're Catholic, then the church is the intermediary for establishing the relationship between the two, and then everything is okay, and you don't have to do anything else, because everything's taken care of. I mean, God takes care of the situation. I mean, what can you do? You're kind of powerless, but you have a relationship with this external, and then everything is okay. But the Buddhist Buddhist view is, that's okay for starters, because people like to think that way, because that's our nature. But it doesn't get you very far. And for one thing, it leaves you in a somewhat disconnected place, because it leaves you in a place where God is still out there, and you're here. And how satisfactory is that? Well, for some people, that's okay. Some people are perfectly fine with that and can develop a sense of devotion to this external idea of God, and that's okay. More complicated is if you think that you and it are the same thing, because that opens all kinds of wormy cans or cans of worms or problems or all kinds of issues that most people don't want to have to think about. Like, if my nature is actually divine or enlightenment consciousness, to use more of the Buddhist language, then how come I'm in this mess? Or how come I'm doing these mean things to other people? Or, more obviously, if you have an enlightenment nature, how come you're doing this mean stuff to me? You don't seem very enlightened. You know, I mean, you go to work and the boss yells at you. The boss doesn't seem very enlightened, to say the least. Or you're on the help desk and you get these phone calls from people and they're saying, what's with my computer or my blackboard or whatever it is, and it's all fouled up and you better fix it, and so on and so forth. And it's kind of like, hey, don't harass me. I'll do the best I can. It's like, you know, it doesn't seem like God's talking to you. It certainly seems like something else is going on, you know. But the Buddhists would say, no, I mean, deep down inside there's this enlightenment nature. It's just buried down there. Why is that? Because that person, like yourself, is living on the surface and is out of touch with their deeper self. If they weren't out of touch with that, they'd pick up the phone and they'd say, you know, Blackboard is the software that we use at the university, so April's smiling about that because she gets it and Kay gets it, that little bit like inside language. It's a very complex system that's used for teaching distance education courses, and it's always on the fritz. And I'm always angry at it myself because my job is to maintain it. But on the other hand, I appreciate it because if it worked flawlessly all the time, I'd be out of a job. So in a way, you know, that's okay. I'm never going to be out of a job because it's never going to work flawlessly. But I get angry at it a lot too. But people call in and they're kind of like angry at it, and it's kind of like, okay, you know, it doesn't really seem like Buddha is talking to me on the help desk line. That's because, you know, the person calling me is out of touch with their Buddha nature, just like I'm out of touch with mine. Because if they called me and were ragging on me a lot and I wasn't out of touch with my Buddha nature, no matter what they said, it wouldn't bother me. So, okay, you know. But we're not there. Anyway, so the practice, though, is getting there and finding that. And so, again, I'm going to say this ad nauseum. You start with it on the outside, and it's a reflection of your inner nature. And you begin through this practice of developing a relationship with it, because actually you don't even have a relationship with your deepest nature. It's there all the time, but you have no relationship with it. So how do you forge a relationship with it? So, for example, you know, appreciate it. Say nice things about it, you know. Ask it for favors if you want, you know, whatever the case may be. So, you know, this little kind of little book of poems that Kate put together is full of that kind of stuff. And basically, that's what those things are. It's like ways of having a nice relationship with your Buddha nature externally, which is a good place to start. Now, for a lot of people, it seems a little weird. It's like, well, what are we doing? We're worshiping the Buddha. I mean, it brings in all the baggage of our Western mentality about what's going on here. And that's unavoidable because we are Westerners dealing with, you know, an Asian system of thought and practice. But fundamentally what it is developing a let's be nice relationship with ourselves projected outward, seeing your reflection and being nice to yourself. Make offerings to yourself. You hungry? Here. Here's something nice. If you want to listen to some nice music? Sure. Here's some nice music, you know. And so all that stuff is in there. But then in time, you know, you bring it inward, and it's you. It's not other than you. It is you. And that practice is bringing these things together. Because it is yourself. And then, you know, once you've made nice with yourself, then it's okay to merge with yourself. I mean, if you have... Well, I won't go there either. Once you've made nice with yourself, then it's okay to merge with yourself. Now, okay. So far, so good. No problem. Okay. But then there's another interesting dimension to things. And so to get to that dimension of things, I want to tell a little bit of a story. So about 20 years ago, Kay and I were students of a Lama by the name of Tara Tolkien. And just before he died, Kay had a chance to meet with him in India. And he was very kind. I mean, 2 days before he died, he says to her, because he's very concerned about her spiritual practice and my spiritual practice, and he says, go see the Dalai Lama. He'll tell you what to do next with your spiritual practice. And 2 days later, he was dead. And so a year or so later, we had a meeting with him to ask him, okay, a Lama sent us to you. We don't know otherwise. Why are we here? And this is what happened to us. And so we said, okay, what are we supposed to do? And he said, well, a number of things. One of the things, he said, go on a retreat. So we went on a long retreat. But the other thing he said was, well, you know, it doesn't really make that much difference whether your Lama is alive or not. That caught us up short. It doesn't make that much difference whether your Lama is alive or not. So one thing I've learned, I've met with His Holiness about a half a dozen times, privately, or with Kay, more or less privately. And one thing I've learned is sometimes he says things that, like, you know, holy man on the hill, cryptic. He'll do that kind of thing. Sometimes he's very direct and, you know, straightforward and concrete. Other times he's incredibly cryptic. Like the last time I met with him, he said something that just really, I'm still dealing with. But anyway, so he said, it doesn't matter if the Lama's alive or not. And he also said, it's important to remember that there's no difference between the Lama and the Yidam, or the Enlightenment image, or the Enlightenment figure, that they're the same. So that was sort of like, okay, what does this mean? And it really began percolating around in my mind, and it's percolated in my mind for almost 20 years now. I want to share with you a little bit of what I thought about that, because it's absolutely relevant to what I was just talking about, which is sort of the prologue to it. And kind of the way I want to get at it is that if your essential nature, if your inner nature is enlightenment awareness, enlightened awareness, my inner nature is enlightenment awareness, and Kay's inner nature is enlightenment awareness, and the kitty cat's inner nature is enlightenment awareness, because all living beings have the same essential underlying awareness, core to their being, if you will. The teacher's inner being is that same enlightenment awareness. So if we're all doing this same thing, which is starting out where we're thinking about our enlightenment mind projected outward, looking like a Buddha, looking like Vajrasattva, looking like a Tara, whatever the case may be. And if you want to do it from a Christian point of view, you know, looking, well, I don't know if I want to say this because I'm not sure what people would think about looking like Jesus or looking like God. Maybe I shouldn't go there. But just having this whole, like, no, I shouldn't go there. Don't go there. Okay, I'm not going to go there. My Western theology is not so hot, and Loy is more the expert. She's saying be careful. So I think I want to be a little bit careful. Let's stay in the Buddhist realm. Okay. So we all have this sort of Right. So we're all doing this meditation practice, including the lamas, by the way, which is you start out with the enlightenment image, the Buddha image, externally, and you forge a relationship with it. You make nice with it. You make offerings, and how are you, and this is great, and here's some nice music, and so on and so forth, and whatnot, which is forging a relationship. Obviously, your enlightenment mind doesn't care about music, doesn't care about food or anything. It doesn't matter. It doesn't care about praise. It's about the relationship. And then you imagine that merging with yourself. The lama's doing the same thing, right? So what does this mean? It means the essence of me, the essence of April, the essence of Kayla, is fundamentally the same. Now, we're still different people, but the essence is the same. The essence of the kitty cat, the same. The essence of the lama, the same. So if you forge a relationship with your essence, you're forming a relationship with everybody's essence, including forming a relationship with the essence of the lama. Okay. So that's what His Holiness meant when He said, on the one hand, the lama and the Buddha figure, the image of the Buddha that you're working with, are the same, because the lama's been working with an image and recognizing, bringing it to himself and recognizing that he and it are united. Just as you recognize that yourself and Vajrasattva unite, that is you reflected externally. So the lama and the image are the same, just as you and the image are the same. I mean, that's logical, actually. But the part that's really interesting, then, is the difference between yourself and the lama, yourself and the teacher. Because it's not a difference in essence, it's a difference of how clearly each of you understands and has the forged relationship with the essence. Because we're spending most of our time disconnected from our true essential nature. The lama spends most of his time connected with his true essential nature, or else he's not a lama. Okay. He's not a guru. Lama is the Tibetan word for guru. So, that opens a very interesting possibility. Bob Thurman referred to the Dalai Lama as a living icon at one point. And at the time he said that, I thought, well, that's interesting. Just didn't think too seriously about it. But I've been thinking much more seriously about it now, because what the Lama represents is, in the same sense, you, I, has a relationship with an inner nature, but the lama's relationship with the inner nature is fulfilled, is realized, is connected more frequently than ours. So the lama represents, in a sense, where we want to go. He represents, in a sense, or she, because there are women lamas, represents where we want to grow to, where we want to develop to through our own practice. And in that sense, the lama represents the goal of practice, in a way in which it's almost tangible, which you can sort of see. When you meet a lama who's luminous, who has obviously extraordinary qualities of compassion or understanding or wisdom, you see what it's like to be a person in full relationship with your essence. And by looking at the lama, you can see where you yourself can grow to. So when the Dalai Lama is saying the lama and the enlightenment figure are one, he's saying that the lama has realized or has achieved or has attained an extraordinary degree of relationship with her own inner nature. And you can see that. And one of the virtues of being around the lama is the ability to see that. That's one of the virtues of being around someone like the Dalai Lama, is you have the opportunity to see that. And to see that in ways which you don't expect. I mean, we've seen him be tough and kick ass. I mean, to be blunt about it, in ways that were just like warm, compassionate, and tough in a way that was terrifying, ferocious, difficult. Because you know, it's kind of like, well, you know, he's for real. and he's not kidding, and you have some faith that what he's saying is true, and so you can't make up things about, oh, well, he's just being mean, and, you know, it's his junk that's being dumped on me, and so on and so forth. So that, and, you know, that makes it tough. That's one side of it. But the other side is all the other good stuff that, you know, he's more popularly recognized for, his sense of humor, compassion, all that good stuff. Okay. So, let's see what we're doing time-wise before I go on. Oh, 25 minutes, so I'll start wrapping this up. So, a virtue of meeting good lamas is recognizing that they are, in a sense, the fulfilled quality of that image that you start to meditate with externally. I think that all makes sense at some point. And the other thing is, when you meet the lamas and you know that, then the image takes on life. See, now, for most of us, we meditate on the image of the Buddha or the image of Vajrasattva, and it's sort of like something that's created in our own mind. You know, we give it certain characteristics based upon what's in our own mind, what we think Buddha would be like. You know, we think of Buddha, as we recite prayers, we think of Buddha as, you know, golden, as luminous, as a smile that cares about everyone, and so on and so forth. But this is mental, and that's okay. That's okay. But we have to construct that. But if you were to meet the Buddha, then you could remember that. You'd actually experience that. You'd actually see that. And then that would make your relationship with that external image very different. It's sort of like if you think, wow, if I could only meet Brad Pitt, since we were talking about 7 years in Tibet. If I could only meet Brad Pitt, you know, wouldn't that be cool? Then I'd know what Brad Pitt was like. And every time I saw a movie with Brad Pitt in it, instead of having this sort of like flat quality of who that person might be, I could remember, oh, I met that person. I know what that person's characteristics are like, you know. He's actually like this. He's actually like this. He has these characteristics. He talks quickly, you know. Or his eyes jump around a lot. You know, it's like if you met Sean Connery, and you see him in the movies, this is a better example. You see Sean Connery in the movies. He has this impeccable British accent, right? But you catch him in an interview, and actually he has this incredible brogue, because I think he's Welsh or Scots or something like that, and he just lets it out, you know? But when he's in the movies, it's like he puts on this accent. So then every time you see him, you say, oh yeah, well that's just an accent where he's really like is like this. So, if you met a Buddha, right, then when you meditate on the Buddha, it would be alive. It would have a different dimension to it, is what I'm trying to say. It would bring the practice alive in a new kind of a way. And that's one of the main virtues, then, of meeting some of these extraordinary beings. I mean, there are teachers around who are good teachers, and then there are teachers who are around who are different. And they're different because of their extraordinary accomplishment. And that extraordinary accomplishment is the successful forging a relationship with their own inner nature. So when you see them, you see your inner nature. And then when you meditate on the external image, you're meditating on a live sense of your own reflection, not an abstract sense of your own reflection. Okay? That all makes sense. That's not too complicated. Okay, good.